Welcome to Monday, is it the 18th? 18th of March. First up on the order, well, first of all, time is about 5 minutes after 1. Representative Seaton, Representative Johnson, Representative Tuck, Representative Tarr, Representative Hawker, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Sadler, and myself, Co-Chair Feige, are present. First up on the agenda is we're going to hear the last of the public testimony for House Bill 158. We've got two guys standing by on the off-net, and Clark Cox from DNR is available for questions. So the first one we'll go to here is Roger Scogan from Kilogenic.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Roger Scogan. I'm a 38-year resident of the village of Kilogenic, which is located 70 air miles northeast of Dillingham in the Bristol Bay. We're in Game Management Unit 17B. I'm a resident hunter and subsistence user. I'm not a guide. And I'm in support of House Bill 158 or something similar to that to limit the number of outfitters in the area. Before 1988, there was one guide in our upper Nooshogak River area. It was an exclusive guide area. And this person, this outfitter, managed the guide area. He protected his resource. If he got a few moose out of one spot, the next year he'd move to another spot to let that population rebound again. And back in those years, there was an abundance of moose, caribou, black bear for all the local resident hunters as well as the outfitter. And just to make a point, the local resident hunters use the resource for their livelihood out here. But in 1988, they had the Osaycheck decision, which opened up state land and the upper Nooshogak River, which is state land, to an unlimited number of guides, each one competing with the other and the local residents for a limited resource. And at the peak of the Mulchatna caribou herd, about 1997, there were as many as 12 outfitter camps in a 10-mile stretch of river from King Salmon to the Chichitna. And it was totally out of control. And because of the competition among all the guides for a limited resource, there was little or no self-management. And I'll just, at one case in point, there was one outfitter that took 25 moose 2 years in a row out of one area, and then he depleted that and moved on to another area. And as a result of this, our moose, black bear populations was harvested to a critical low, and then have still not rebounded to this day. So this is a major concern to all the resident hunters who depend on the resource for their livelihood, and it's also a problem for some of the guides because of all the traffic and stuff. They don't have the quality hunt that they used to have when they just had the exclusive guide area. We would like to see it return to something similar to the EGA that they had back prior to 1988. This would offer less game management problems, and it would maintain an abundance of resource for all the parties involved. There's one other thing that House Bill 158 does not address, and that's issue of transporters. And back at the peak of the Mulchatna caribou herd, which is about 1997 to the mid-2000s, it was a huge problem. Thousands of drop-off hunters came in. They'd drop them off on plains and drop them off around the caribou herd, and they pretty much devastated the Mulchatna caribou herd. So this is an issue that we believe also that needs to be addressed. So in closing, I'd just like to thank you again for the comment, and we are in support of House Bill 158. One other thing, there's one more person that came in and that was here Friday and didn't get to speak, and that's Bobby Larson. Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Scogan. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you for taking the time, Mr. Scogan. Next up, Nick Johnson, also from Kilogenic.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share. I support House Bill 158. The reason for that is that us local distance hunters are having a hard time competing with all these guide hunters because they, ever since the bear hunting season open during our moose hunt, it's really hard for us locals trying to catch our moose. Really competing out there, and they're running the main river and the Nuyakuk River and the Malchatna River, so we very hard for us local people here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions for Mr. Nick Johnson? And to note, we've been joined by Representative Olson. And the gentleman said there was the third fellow from Friday has arrived.
Yes.
If you would just state your name, go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Bobby Larson, Sr. and part of Hospital 158, resident and subsistence hunter. And this bill, I think, would better manage our resources to sustain in our area. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate you taking the time to testify. At this time, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 158, and we will eventually deal with amendments. For today, we do have a number of amendments in front of us. I'm going to set the bill aside, and we will deal with those amendments here at a future date. Ready? This time, we'll just call a brief at ease, and myself and Rep. Satter will change seats.
Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Satter is co-chair. House Resources will now take up Senate Bill 27, which is regulation of dredge and fill activities. The committee did hear the identical version, the House version 78, back in February 1st. At that meeting, we did hear testimony from DEC and DNR, and committee members had a chance to ask questions of those officials. So, for most practical purposes, this is our second hearing on this legislation. Today, we again have the departments here to give us a brief recap of the bill and respond to additional questions in the audience and online. We have, in no particular order, Commissioner of DEC Larry Hartig. He's on the off-net. Ed Fogles, DNR Deputy Commissioner. In the front row, Tom Crawford, DNR's Director of OPUMP. Michelle Bonnet Hale, DEC's Water Division Director, and Ruth Hamilton Hess, the Department of Law's AAG on this topic. So with that, I would ask the department, I'm not sure if, Ed, if you want to come up or have... Okay, I guess we'll go to Commissioner Larry Hartig on the teleconference. Can you hear us, sir?
Yes, I can, Chairman Satter. Thank you.
Hey, if you want to give us a kind of a brief recap and boot us up again on this legislation, what it does, kick us off.
Yes, I appreciate that opportunity. This is Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And as the co-chair mentioned, I was before you back on February 1st, along with Commissioner Solomon, to introduce HB 78, which is the same as Senate Bill 27. There were no amendments. You're seeing the same bill that you saw back on February 1st. At that time, I walked you through what is the 404 permitting program. We talked about the steps that the state would have to go through to assume primacy, why assumption of the 404 permitting program is very important to Alaska, and Commissioner Sullivan specifically spoke to how it fits in well with the administration's broader efforts to make permitting actions more efficient and predictable in the state. And lastly, we talked about what the fiscal impact might be of the bill and talked a bit about the fiscal note. So I'll just hit some of those high points, and then if the chairman wishes, we can open up for questions and detailed questions for the people there in the room. But first, what is the 404 program? Again, this is one of the two big Clean Water Act programs, the other one being the 402 Wastewater Discharge Permitting Program, for which DEC recently got primacy. The 404 program is sometimes called dredge and fill program or the wetlands program, because what it deals with is the permitting of fill material being placed into waters of the U.S., including wetlands. And since Alaska has 174 million acres of wetlands, about 65% of the wetlands in the nation, this is a very critical program to the state. Indeed, we see that most large resource permitting projects require 404 permits. Currently, that program is administered by the Corps of Engineers with EPA's oversight, but the Clean Water Act specifically provides for states to take primacy over that program. And so what are the steps to get primacy? We have to go through a pretty rigorous process of developing an application and come up with a program that contains the essential elements of what the federal government is providing. We don't change the rules here, but what we can do is bring our own program where we have the ability to set our own priorities, what permits go first. We also have, with the legislators' help, the ability to make sure that we have the resources to give timely turnaround on permit applications. But the application that we submit, if it's anything like it was for the 402 program, it takes a while to develop it. We're talking several years here and probably a foot-high pile of documents by the time it's said and done. But we get that application in, and it's up to the Environmental Protection Agency to review that and decide whether to grant primacy, just as it was on the 402 program. And then if we get primacy, it doesn't mean that we issue all the 404 permits in the state, because there's a geographic limitation on this program, so that it we would not get primacy for issuing 404 permits where the fill material is going into tidally influenced waters and waters that are or could be used for interstate and foreign commerce and wetlands adjacent to those waters. So what this means is that as we go through this application process, developing our application, we anticipate there will be a lot of dialogue with the Corps of Engineers and EPA in regards to the interpretation, the application of these terms, and trying to build a consensus on exactly what areas of the state, what permits within those areas would the state be taking primacy. As a side here, but a very important one, there's actually two components to this bill. One is the, along the lines of what I just mentioned, for the state to pursue primacy for the 404 permitting program. But the other is for the state to work with the Corps of Engineers to evaluate the opportunities for the Corps to issue in the state to administer what are called state programmatic general permits. And these are permits, again, that authorize dredge and fill actions, but they're more limited in terms of the nature, not the geographic area, but in the nature of the actions, the dredge and fill activity that's being permitted. These are for activities that are similar in nature and have minimal or individual cumulative impacts, so that you can issue one permit and then different permittees could just ask to be authorized under that general permit without having to pursue their own permit. So we think there's a lot of opportunity there too. So another part of this bill is for us to not only pursue primacy but also to pursue getting the Corps to issue these type of permits for us to administer those permits. These two pieces of the bill are not mutually exclusive. Lastly, what we talked about is the importance of the 404 program to Alaska. I mentioned the propensity of wetlands in the state, and that the fact that many large resource projects require 404 permits, and that the state, in a sense, has its ability to control its own destiny, at least as to the prioritization to give these permits. As we all know, large projects, permitting projects, any kind of delay means additional cost, sometimes substantial cost for the project. So the ability to be able to competently and quickly respond to permit applications is essential. Also, having the permittees, the permitting staff close to the permittees and able to answer questions and also to be held accountable to the legislature and to the public is, we see, critical to building a responsive program. Finally, the fiscal impacts. Unfortunately, we're not able to give a lot of detail in the out years on this. I know we'd like to be able to and you'd like to see it, but we can't because, again, there's some contingencies here in terms of what it is exactly we'll get from the Corps and what programmatic general permits will be developed. But we can say with confidence what the cost and the resources needed for the program to do the initial steps of evaluating the costs and benefits of primacy and start putting together an application and building the capacity to take the program if we get it. Those costs we can pretty much say because we've been through this before with 402. But once we get to about fiscal year 16, that's when we think we'll start being able to have better definition what a program would look like if the state takes it over. And at that time, we would anticipate being back to the legislature before going to the next step of actually building the program, you know, submitting the application, building the program. So that's my introduction today, Co-Chair Sadler, and certainly open for questions along with the other people in the room there.
Yep. Questions for Commissioner D.C. from the committee? Representative Seaton, Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions we asked last time was how many Corps or other federal folks are currently working on 404 permits within the state of Alaska.
Representative Seaton, break. I hear someone's cell phone making some interesting interferences, so if you've got a cell phone, make sure it's dead. Go ahead.
Well, see, yeah, through the chair, Representative Seaton, right now, if I recall, there's 49 Corps employees, but again, I don't know if they're all working on permitting and whether they're all working on permits. I know they're not all the permits they're working on would not come to the state because many of those would be in geographic areas that would be excluded from the program under primacy. But if I can, maybe I can turn it over to our water director, Michelle Hale, to answer that in more detail.
Great. Ms. Hale, if you'd come forward and give us your name and the record and take a whack at that question.
Yes, my name is Michelle Bonnet Hale, and I am the director of DEC's Division of Water. And I probably can't say a lot more than what the commissioner has said. As we understand it, the Corps has 49 employees and a budget of less than $8 million for their 404 permitting activities. However, we don't have a precise breakdown of those permitting activities, and as the commissioner said, since we don't know what percentage of the program we would be able to assume from the Corps, we really can't tell what the actual number of positions that the state would need. I think we can probably be relatively certain that it wouldn't be more than 49, but I don't know how much less than 49 it would actually be.
Oh,
I have another question, but I can.
To be fair, let's go back and forth. So, Representative Tuck.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is an attempt to try to reduce the backlog that we have with the federal government. Do we have any idea what the backlog is for Alaskans trying to get permits?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I have an estimate that there are, the Corps has provided us an estimate that there are some 50 or 50 plus people waiting for permits that aren't able to get them at this time. Again, that's just a rough estimate, and I don't know how accurate that is.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And then if there's a way we can get that information and find out how long some people have been applying for their permits, what's the average permit applicant? And I don't know if we can compare that to other states. I'm not sure if you can. Just to find out, you know, how we're going to be able to reduce these number of permits by having primacy.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I can try to find that information from the Corps.
Yes. Okay, thank you. I mean applications. Thanks.
Is it actually, on the same point, is it a delay in the permitting process or is it a delay in the actual NEPA process? Or what are the significant elements of the time it takes to secure a 404 permit under current federal administration?
Chairman Sadler, I can speak to some of the delays that are occurring in that backlog. One of the things that's going on right now is the Corps has experienced significant reductions in staff and in their budget, and that's seriously impacting their ability to issue permits at this point. In terms of the delays in the NEPA process, I think that Tom Crawford with DNR might be able to explain that a little better than I can.
Does that help, Representative Tuck?
Yes, it will. Thank you.
Tom, if you don't mind coming up, and why don't you just scooch over and go back and forth.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Crawford, and I'm the director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting in the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. We don't necessarily have real details to provide at this point in time. However, I think it's particularly appropriate to point out that because the 404 permit is now basically the federal permit for most resource development projects, it means that the Army Corps of Engineers is the de facto lead agency for the NEPA process for large projects. And And at this day and age, when the Corps of Engineers is undergoing staffing reductions and budget cuts, at a point in time when they are now having to shoulder the burden of being that lead federal agency, we think that this is an issue, and it's potentially a growing issue because of simply their capacity to address that additional workload that had previously fallen primarily upon the EPA back when the EPA had responsibility for issuing wastewater discharge permits under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. And I'm sure you and the members of the committee recall that the state received primacy, or it was a phased implementation of primacy for 402 permitting, but I believe that was completed last year. And so at this point in time, when the Corps of Engineers, I mean, we're really needing the Corps of Engineers to shoulder an additional burden, and we're being told that that they are experiencing staffing and budgeting cuts, and that's a major concern to us.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And these cuts that you're talking about was before sequestration all kicked in.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct. We were hearing of these cuts prior to sequestration kicking in. And what's more, if I may add, that the cuts and the departures and staffing have been disproportionately occurring at the higher levels within the organization. And so that's an additional concern to us, because some of the people that that we regarded as the most experienced members of the core regulatory branch in Alaska have either been retiring or moving elsewhere, and that loss of the, you know, the senior staff is an additional concern.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The commissioner mentioned the general permits, and of course, you know, we've just been dealing with this regional general permits down in Homer. We have 70 plus miles of gas line in Homer and 9 miles of gas line to put in Ketchumack City. And working with the Corps of Engineers, we got a regional general permit to expedite that. So I'm trying to figure out, does the state feel that general permits aren't being given now, or I mean, it seemed like that was a part of this to do general permits, but our experience in the last 2 years is that general permits are available, and so, you know, our only thing was told that, hey, if you apply for this in the summer, we're not going to be able to do it because of the workload, because that's when a lot of assessments go, but, you know, putting it in the winter, it was only a 9-month process. So I'm trying to figure out where that works with DNR.
Yes. Okay.
The way that the statewide general permits can, statewide programmatic general permits can work is they would add to the type of general permits that you're talking about that the Corps is already able to administer. But there's the ability for states and the Corps to work together to issue a statewide programmatic general permit, and then the state to actually administer that permit. So that would provide us the ability to, one, learn the programs by working with the Corps, and two, then administer that general permit and take advantage of some of the efficiencies that we've already implemented. Both DNR and DEC have already implemented as part of the permit reform. So, for example, some of our online permitting application systems, that kind of thing.
And just a follow-up, I guess I'm trying to figure out, are you not able to do that now without having primacy? Because, I mean, we had the general permit down in the Homer area, and it seemed to go fairly easily.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, actually the way the statewide programmatic general permit program works, including this ability for the state to work with the Corps, we don't have to have primacy in order to do that. So this is kind of a twofold approach. We're both studying assuming primacy for the program overall, and at the same time planning to work with the Corps on issuing some of these statewide programmatic general permits. And where we see a real need is, for example, in some common activities like placer mining. I believe there's a real backlog in placer mining permit processing. If shale oil becomes a big situation in Alaska, we might be able to work with the Corps on developing some of these statewide programmatic general permits.
Can Representative Seaton follow up?
So just for clarity, for the statewide general permits to work with the Corps or regional general permits, we don't have to have primacy. I mean, you're proceeding with that currently, trying to get that program in place.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we're not proceeding with that right now, but that's part of the work that would occur should this bill pass.
So to clarify, the legislation and the program that DEC would take on would be to pursue primacy, to evaluate, and as well as state programmatic general permitting, kind of in parallel. One's kind of like primacy light.
Chairman Sadler, that's correct. The idea would be to pursue both at the same time, and there are significant benefits to pursuing the statewide programmatic general permits at the same time that we're looking at primacy. In the first place, it would benefit the applicants because they would have they'd have less of a backlog and a shorter turnaround time, and we would learn a lot about the program as we were doing that, which would benefit the application process.
Okay. Mr. Crawford.
If I may, Co-Chair Sadler, an important point to include and remember is that general permits, be they state programmatic general permits or there are nationwide general permits and regional general permits, but the underlying premise behind a general permit is that the adverse impacts are both individually and cumulatively minimal. Now, minimal is not a defined term, but it's clear that those general permits are to apply to a kind of a recurring type of activity and an activity that's of a lesser level of impact. And so a lot of very large kinds of development projects are not going to be eligible for a general permit. Additionally, though, a real advantage of those general permits is that they can be applicable to lands that the state would be eligible to receive primacy for and the lands that the federal government would have to retain primacy for that. So they're not geographically limited. And that's why, or at least that's one of the reasons why, the state would be simultaneously looking at primacy and opportunities to assume these general permits under a state programmatic general permit.
Okay. Question, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Can you point out in the bill where you get the authority to do this general permit or where you don't currently have the authority to do a general permit and it's granted in this bill?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we have the authority now to pursue statewide programmatic general permits. What this bill would do is give us the resources.
I got a question. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Tarr.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We just had Dave Casey, who's the Regulatory Division Supervisor for the Corps, come in front of the Admin Reg Review Committee, and he was talking about how 62% of their general permits and almost 85% of those are processed in less than 60 days. And then the remaining almost 37% that are individual permits, almost 70% of them are processed in less than 120 days. So he didn't speak about there being really much of a significant backlog, but those were actually the time periods it took from a completed application being turned into a permit being issued. So where is the backlog in this permit process?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the figure of 50-plus, that backlog figure, is actually a figure that I've received in communication with the Corps, but I don't have the slides that you're referring to, and so I can't, I don't have the precise number from the Corps.
Okay. Follow up, Representative.
And just for members, they made over 1,100 decisions last year, so I'll get that information to other members. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Crawford,
if I may be allowed to kind of add to that, the the Corps of Engineers has recently reported, I believe that it's about 1,500, I think over the past 5 years, I think it's something like 1,536 actions per year. And that means both general permits and individual permits. And the permitting process, I think those summary statistics merit a little more attention. And I say that because in the permitting process for 404 permits, a whole lot of the work actually precedes the actual application or submittal of an application, because a whole lot of the work is in the process of coming up with what's deemed to be a complete application. And there are some statistics out there that they're kind of aged statistics. I think they date to 2008, although I'm not sure, that indicated that some 700 and some odd days and $270,000 are spent creating a complete application. And so the summary statistics about the times and the numbers of permits don't really reflect all of that time that's required to get to a completed application in the first place. And beyond that, I think where some of the real difficulties have arisen have not been so much with this the greater suite of permits, but some of the specific projects that are of real significance to the state, that where there have been some real difficulties getting to the issuance of a permit, and I guess the example that comes to mind is CD5, and there was a several year delay, and as we know, the cost and the consequence of those kinds of delays on major projects can be a real concern. Yeah.
I got a question for you. The backup information, the bill indicates that one of the benefits of the state assuming the primacy over dredge and fill activities is that activities would not automatically trigger a NEPA process as they currently do under the Corps and EPAs. What's the average length of time it takes to get a wetlands dredge and fill permit having to go through the NEPA process? That's a broad question, but give some idea what the timelines are like.
Chairman Sadler, sorry, I really don't have a good answer for you there. The NEPA process is really an open-ended process, and while there are specific steps, and when some of those steps are triggered, there are like specific opportunities and durations for comment periods, but the actual NEPA process kind of takes as long as it takes. And so there would be quite a difference in the durations for different projects in accordance with kind of the complexity of that project. So I'm sorry, I really don't have a good answer for you. I don't know, Michelle, do you have anything to add?
I want to ask an average, so just some, you know, 2 months, 5 months, 5 years.
Chairman Sadler, I think generally speaking, when we talk about the NEPA process, we're generally thinking in the frame of something on the order of 3 years for a large development project.
Okay. Questions? I see Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. I guess I was a little confused. It took a fairly long time to get an application complete and all the data to submit to make a completed application. Are you saying that if the state's doing it, all that time goes away and or is severely reduced and they don't need the same amount of data to make an application?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, no, I'm not saying that. And I think that's part of our evaluation process. We would need to determine during this evaluation just what might be involved, what we think, what opportunities there might be for perhaps introducing efficiencies to that process, and that really the intent of the bill is to evaluate that and determine where and if we would be able to provide those efficiencies to the program. So that's those are questions that we would seek to answer with this process.
I've got a question. I'm not sure if either you can answer or the Commissioner Hardy could answer. Can you kind of place this, the wetlands primacy, in context of of where the state stands in terms of taking over federal programs in air water quality, where this stands, how long it would take. Ms. Hale, if you want to take a crack at that.
Chairman Sadler, I can address that from a water quality perspective, not really from the broader perspective. I think I'd have to defer to the commissioner to do that. But from the water perspective, as many of you know, we have recently, and as Tom referred to, we have recently assumed primacy for the 402 program, which is the wastewater discharge permitting program. And in October of 2012, we received primacy for the fourth and final phase of that program. We took that on in a phased fashion. And we began, actually it was probably a little more than a decade ago that we began seriously pursuing applying for that program, and spent quite a few years and actually made several trips back to the legislature as we applied for that program. We received the first phase in October of 2008, and then have received the final three phases over the years. That program actually, it was an incredible learning experience for us as a state when it comes to taking on a program from the federal agencies. I think it was also really a good learning experience in a way for EPA, and EPA is the agency that we'll be applying to with the 404 program. Initially, they weren't really sure that we were serious, so it took a little back and forth before we really kind of came, you know, we're on the same page in terms of our seriousness in making the application. And we've got that experience both in applying and taking on the program. So we've got a program that is truly becoming a mature program now. We're very pleased with how that program's operating, and that experience has put us in a very good position for taking on the 404 program. So these are the two big programs that you can take on under the Clean Water Act that a state can take on.
With your indulgence, can you amplify why does it put us in a good position? Why now?
The experience of taking on a program of this magnitude, Chairman Sadler, it's a daunting task, actually, and it's a daunting task both applying for the program, but then actually when you apply for the program, you have to write a very complete program description. You have to say how you're going to do it, what kind of staff you're going to use or going to need to actually run the program. You've got to describe in great detail how you'll do it, and then you have to implement it. So you actually have to hire the staff. You have to get the staff actually to understand. You have to have them trained to understand actually how to actually run the program. Having just done that and having actually transformed our program from the fledgling APDS program to the mature program that it is now, it really does position us well for taking on another big program, both in the application, in the sense of the application, and in the actual doing of the program.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With permission, just to set up my question, just wanted to read a couple of things. In the AOGA letter that was sent to us, they say state primacy of dredge and fill permitting, however, may pose administrative and financial barriers. And then they go on to say that, the requirement that the state assumes this all at once can result in a complex, lengthy, and expansive process with no certainty that EPA will approve their request. And when I looked back at an article from when we were trying to take over the NPDES permitting, they discuss in this Journal of Commerce article about the cost to the permit applicants, and it says that DEC has estimated on average total cost for obtaining the permits will increase by about 80%. For example, if a company or municipality now pays $1,000 for the state certification of the federal permit, cost will increase to $1,800, and 80% increase is only an average. So do we expect a similar situation here with permit applications, and how much of a cost increase do you expect, if so?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, it's very hard to tell at this point what the cost increase would be. I think that would be part of our evaluation process. One would expect that there might be some increase in costs if we're doing the bulk of the work rather than certifying projects, but again, it's just very hard to tell at this point without going through the evaluation process.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and follow up. I got a comment.
So it wouldn't be an extraordinary situation to think that costs could rise in, similarly as they did in that situation by 80%?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I suppose that's possible, but I really can't say without actually having a better understanding of what it would take to issue these permits.
And actually, commenting, reading through, I can't find it right now, but there is information in the packet indicating that, yes, while the individual permit process, the application, rather, process might cost more, the streamlining and the shortening of the process, the net result would be less cost to the applicant. Although the individual application fee might be higher, the overall cost of the process will be lower. And I'll keep looking for that, Representative Tarr. I'll provide that to you. Actually, there was a question that came up about whether the what is the end result of the evaluation process. If the state prepares that complicated application, statement of qualifications, et cetera, is the federal government, is EPA obligated to grant the state primacy, or is that still at their discretion? Can you speak to that? Maybe the attorney commissioner could answer that question.
Chairman Sadler, I think
that was very hard to take, Chairman Sadler. One thing, if I just go back to the previous question quickly, one of the savings that we would anticipate would be not having to go through NEPA and not having necessarily to go through the ESA consultation, and there could be streamlining there. Not that we wouldn't look at alternatives and the best alternatives for the project, but there are reasons to believe that there would be actual cost savings, and on the larger projects, just getting permits out and getting them in your hand more quickly and not losing a construction season can be make a big cost difference. And so when it comes down to the decision point of coming back to the legislature and asking for the positions and the funding to go forward, I expect that industry, as I mentioned in my testimony back 1st of February, industry will be there. You know, they will have evaluated it with us, and they'll have their own opinion. And if they disagree with us, whether it's a good thing to go forward, they'll let you know, but I suspect they'll be supporting it. But to go on to your last question, I don't know, maybe Ruth Hesse, we could finish this, but there, when we applied for primacy on the 402 program, it did go through an appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and just prior to us getting primacy, Arizona had gotten primacy, and their EPA's decision to grant them primacy had also gone up to a different circuit court. But what we learned from that is that if your application is complete, then no, EPA doesn't have discretion, but there's a lot of, I guess, due deference given to the agency in deciding what's complete and whether you have a comparable program. So although it's written as EPA shall approve an application that's complete, again, it gets back to a judgment call on whether it is or not.
I see someone coming to the table with more information. Yes. Give us your name for the record, please.
Chairman Sadler, my name is Ruth Hamilton Hesse. I'm with the Alaska Department of Law, and I work with DEC and DNR on this bill. As to what Commissioner Hartig just relayed, that is all accurate. There are, for Section 402, 9 criteria by which EPA reviews an application for that 402 program, and if the state satisfies a state, any state, satisfies those criteria, they are entitled to approval of their program. There are criteria, I believe, under for Section 404 that we would need to look at that would also pertain to the approval of a 404 program. But I think, as Commissioner Hartig also said, there's a lot of back and forth between the state and the federal agencies with respect to whether they are comfortable that there's sufficient information in the state's application to satisfy the criteria. So there's still some discretion involved, but ultimately, if the state provides the information that satisfies the criteria, the federal agencies are supposed to approve.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Hess while she's up? If not, I've got more. can I ask, the question was touched on in previous testimony, that the Clean Water Act either envisions or intends for states to take over this program. Can either you Ruth or the Commissioner characterize the alacrity with which the federal government is trying to encourage states to take on primacy for wetlands or not?
I might defer to Commissioner Hartig first on this, if that's okay.
Certainly.
Well, I haven't heard of, Chairman Zettler, I haven't heard of any concerted effort by the Corps to get states to take on the 404 program. It doesn't surprise me that they're not all lined up to get it, particularly when I think of the western states with big resource projects, because they don't have a lot of wetlands. They don't have a lot of water. And so it would make sense to me that Alaska would be one of the first ones. And so I look at what has the reaction to date been among the federal agencies when they've only known for a couple of months here that the state is potentially pursuing primacy. And I'd say that they're generally being helpful in helping us evaluate what it would take. We have a conference call this scheduled this Friday with DNR, DEC management, Assistant Attorney General, and then the Regional Administrator of EPA, the head of the Corps for Alaska, and their senior program people from headquarters to go over what would be involved in the application and steps, because we want to make sure as we keep testifying like this that, you know, we're seeing it correctly. We believe we are. But also just to talk about what it would take to get started. So I would say that although there's not like a national effort to try to get program states to take primacy, I certainly see a collaborative effort from so far in the federal agency's reaction to our potential application.
Okay. You want to follow up?
The only thing I would add to that is that several states have looked at taking on the program and have evaluated it in varying degrees of detail, and so there is no, I think, there's ample opportunity for several states to have had dialogue with the agencies, the federal agencies, on the program.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson, question?
I don't have a, I have a question for the commissioner, maybe. In your DEC fact sheet benefits, the last bullet, the last sentence says, not taking primacy has consequences that need to be considered as the state tries to build up its infrastructure and put citizens to work. Would you like to go into that in a little bit more detail?
Mr. Hartig?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe what we're talking to there, again, is just the propensity of wetlands in the states and the number of projects in the state, particularly larger projects that are going to trigger 404 permitting and through that NEPA and ESA consultation and potential ESA issues and on and on. And that there's a cost to all of that in terms of the complexity of it and potential delays if things aren't handled expeditiously, efficiently. And so there's a lot at stake in Alaska in development of our resources and to make sure that we have a good, well-performing 404 program. And when you look at what's happening with the federal government today in terms of declining budgets and perhaps less amenable to resource projects in Alaska, that concern over the 404 program only becomes greater. And where you have the original Clean Water Act saying we want the states to run these programs and this is the way it should work, it seems like we should at least take this opportunity to look at it very carefully before we assume that, you know, staying on the path we're on right now with federal primacy is the best course for the state. So that I think right now with the need for more resource development in the state, good resource development, responsible resource development, and the ability the state perhaps to take this on and perhaps do a more efficient job over the long term, we should be looking at this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have Tar and Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to make sure maybe the commissioner or someone else can respond to this, because in the core presentation that I received in another committee, even if we take over this and have jurisdiction, the core would still retain the jurisdiction for tidal waters and adjacent wetlands, navigable waters and adjacent wetlands, and navigable waters under Section 10. So I believe that's all still true. So just trying to think of the cost-benefit analysis, because certainly that would account for a large number of the wetlands in the state, as to how just it would be worth then spending, you know, upwards of $10 million just on an application. And if we look at the DEC example with NPDES primacy, we're currently at 18 new positions for that, one of which we weren't even able to fund this year and had to just be absorbed by the department. So trying to understand, really, given the enormous cost and the limited resources for the department, why this would be a good priority for this time.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I think that's why that this bill and the process is structured the way that it is, that this is an evaluation at this point in time. And we would need to determine just what it would be that we would be eligible to acquire in terms of primacy, what the cost and what the number of positions that would be required would be. And so we would have to come back to the legislature with a fully fleshed out program and the number of positions and the funding that would be required so that the legislature could make an informed decision on whether or not it's worth it. Mm-hmm. And so at this stage, this is an evaluation. Mm-hmm. And there would be a subsequent stage of whether or not to go the whole route and actually assume primacy.
It'd probably be good to get on the record now. I'm not sure, Tom, if you or the commissioner would be the best person to answer this, but how much wetlands in Alaska is actually tidally influenced or could be used for interstate or foreign commerce?
To Chairman Sadler, I don't think we know that answer right now. I think that an important point probably to take note of is that really a disproportionate number of the permits are in the coastal areas, and that's because that's where most of the population really is. And so to just think in terms of what area the state would assume primacy for or could be assume primacy for, you need to also think in terms of what the actual permitting workload would be, because the numbers of permits are higher in that coastal area. And so that's part of the evaluation that needs to take place, as to just what we would get and what the scale of it would be.
If I can follow up my own question here, there's a reference made in the AOGA letter of February 4th on page 2 that says, we, AOGA, applaud the administration's spoken objective to also pursue shared general permitting responsibility in non-municipal waters. Is state programmatic general permitting authority, would that apply to these coastal areas that are navigable waters and therefore subject to interstate and foreign commerce?
Chairman Sadler, indeed it would. If the state received state programmatic general permitting authority, that would not be geographically limited. So it would apply to lands for which the federal agencies would retain primacy, as well as lands that the state would be eligible to have primacy for.
But again, these are answers you would come up with as you evaluated. Okay. Great. Representative Seaton had a question.
Thank you. Reviewing materials, we have this December 2012 case or study of costs and benefits for the assumption of 404 Clean Water Act permitting program, which was given by Department of Environmental Quality to Governor McDonald of Virginia. And, you know, it has just been issued, but it says currently only two states have assumed 404 within their borders. This is due mainly to prohibitive costs and complexities involved in the assumption process. And then they had a big stakeholders group, and the stakeholders, when polled, the majority of members of stakeholders believe the cost of assuming 404 outweigh the potential benefits of assumptions. Have you reviewed the process that they went through and just in December of 2012 came out with a feasibility study and decided not to go forward with that?
And Representative Seaton, could you refer, is this the packet, what are you referring to here?
I had this, maybe, it's, let me reference it, it's called Study of Cost and Benefits of State Assumption of Federal 404 Clean Water Act Permitting Program, a report to the Honorable Robert F. McDonald, Governor, and the General Assembly of Virginia, by the Department of Environmental Quality, and that was December 2012. If it's not available in the packet, I'll get it for you. My staff might have pulled it up for me.
That'd be great if you could. We can get copies. Sure, if we can get copies now and distribute if you'd like, but that'd be great.
That'd be great.
Okay, if we could. So with that, can you address the question about Mr. Crawford?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I know the document that you're referring to. I'm aware that the state of Virginia recently went through that process. We are in the process of evaluating the similarities and differences between other state experiences and Alaska's circumstances. And in fact, Deputy Commissioner of DEC, Lynn Kent, is, I believe she's traveling to West Virginia today to attend in a conference of the Association of State Wetlands Managers. And the state experiences with their various different attempts or the degrees to the which they went down that road towards state primacy is to be one of the discussion topics there. And I anticipate that one of the organizers of that that meeting is, I believe, the gentleman that you referred to, who was the architect of that report. And so we're in that process. I think it's worth pointing out that at least I would anticipate that the bulk of the wetlands in Virginia would probably be in the coastal areas that they would not be eligible to obtain primacy for. I think in Alaska, wetlands are more widely distributed within the interior of the state. And so I think that would be, without having done a detailed analysis, I would at least anticipate that would be a major difference between Virginia and Alaska.
And be happy to get this to everybody.
Thank you.
But one thing that they do note is that Virginia's existing SPGA, GP, their general permit, provides many of the benefits identified for potential benefits of 404 assumption without the costs associated with the assumption. So in lieu of assuming 404, they're suggesting what you're talking about, that you have the ability to proceed with those statewide general permit assumptions. So, but Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out one other thing in the definitions here. There's a section on ephemeral streams, and it says ephemeral streams fall under the category of non-navigable and not relatively permanent tributaries. And following the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Rapinos versus United States and Carabel versus United States, fall under federal jurisdiction when they have a significant nexus to traditional navigable waters. So that means these streams that aren't even flowing year-round, and there are primarily from runoff, not from groundwater, are still going to be under federal jurisdiction according to those two Supreme Court decisions. So I guess the amount of territory that we might be looking at might be smaller than we would anticipate. So I'll make sure everybody gets this.
Fair enough. I in my experience with wetlands issues, certainly there's a lot of attorneys involved. As I understand, one of the benefits of the state assuming this primacy is that some such questions might be decided in state jurisdictions as opposed to federal. And I guess from the Department of Law, can you comment to that?
The Rapinos case is...
I'll tell your name for the record. Thanks.
Certainly, Representative Chair Sadler. Sorry, this is Ruth Hamilton Hesse. The Rapinos case that Representative Seaton references is still being teased out even to today. They're trying to figure out guidance for implementing the two tests that came out of two major opinions in that case. What would be considered federal waters in the first instance may not, in the end, for a primacy program, for a 404 primacy program, may not be as cut and dry as we would all hope in terms of what would still be tidally influenced navigable waters. And so the evaluation that the state would be embarking upon would be looking at those two tests and some of those issues over the course of the next 2 to 4 years. So. It's a difficult case to grapple with. many attorneys will disagree how it should be applied and interpreted.
Questions? Okay. I got another question, I guess. And I guess I'm not quite sure who can best speak to this. Maybe the commissioner might be the best person. Would assuming wetlands primacy, what would the effect be on the ability of locally impacted communities to comment? Would they be more or less, would they have a larger or smaller opportunity to weigh in on development activities?
Chairman Sadler, it's Larry Hartig, D.C. Commissioner again. That was a question that came up, of course, in our 402 primacy effort. And what DEC did there is we worked closely with EPA to go out and talk with the tribes and develop a communication protocol, not just for the tribes, but also for rural Alaska. We even put in a pilot program and won a national award, or grant, I guess, national grant, to pursue a pilot project on how we would do an enhanced communication project. And developed that with a series of villages, a group of villages on the Yukon. And so we took that effort seriously, and I would see the same thing on the 404, and I can say that we'd have, at a minimum, comparable communication, if not better. That would be our goal with the rural stakeholders, including the tribes.
Okay. Thank you. I don't mean to monopolize questions. Your other committee members' questions for the Representative Hawker?
Sure. Would it be the will of the chair to allow me to do a drill down on the fiscal note?
I certainly doubt it. There's other questions before we go financial on them that might be, we'll hold that in abeyance, but seeing no great objection that you're going to hold that in abeyance for a few moments.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I wanted to speak about that same topic. So in the document that was prepared by the department for the Senate Finance Committee, there's a paragraph in here comparing the 402 and 404 process, and it says one difference in the two passes to primacy is that DEC was already operating a robust wastewater permitting program, and the existing 29 positions were transferred to the 402. While DEC and DNR have significant experience on large projects with the 404, the current DEC investment is about 3 to 4 full-time equivalent spread over approximately 7 employees. So, and when we look at those fiscal notes, I guess it's hard for me to make a determination about whether it's even worth the evaluation, since that's several million dollars, without having at least some direction about the anticipated fiscal impact of a program. Should we take it over? So if that could be part of the discussion with Representative Hawker's questions about the fiscal note, I would appreciate that.
So your question goes to, is it worth it?
Yeah, and if we don't currently have positions that would transfer over for this particular program. So just trying to get some kind of idea of what kind of permanent commitment we are making in terms of staffing levels, because should we not fulfill that permanent commitment, the federal government would take the program back from us, and that could cause further delays. So just trying to put the big picture together what kind of commitment this would be.
Right. I believe we do have testimony that the actual costs are a little bit indeterminate, and so you don't know until you ask. So you can't presume they're bad. You can't presume they're good. You got to ask. But with that, Representative Hawker, if you got a line of questioning on the fiscal impact or fiscal arrangements for the bill?
Only if I have the permission of the chair, sir.
He says yes.
Okay, thank you. Yes, 2 points. I take go back to the committee minutes from February 1st, when you're last here, and we were talking about how this is, in fact, a two-stage process in the current fiscal note through 2016. And I'd like to preface this. I've got a couple of directions that I need to flesh out for my own comfort level here. This is the sort of the germinal work, that exploratory work, that determining how a program might be administrated and operated. This was not, in fact, a fiscal note that represented the all-in costs of operating the program that would be put into place sometime after 2016. And now the fiscal note before us, RESB 27, does state that after FY16 and program approval, Some costs will be offset by program receipts, but okay, that very kind of a vague comment there, and I do get that. But at the end of the meeting, we, you know, we determined that it was in fact a fiscal note that was a research fiscal note rather than a program implementation. I had asked some estimate of all-in costs after 2016 for truly implementing a program, and respectfully, I have had no response to date. To the best of my knowledge, nothing's been delivered to the chairs. And I just heard a comment from the chair, and maybe that's all I get. But I would like to have personally an estimate of what, you know, again, we all understand those are vagaries out in the future, but we could certainly, I believe, bracket what those, what might be anticipated based on our previous experience. So that's editorial, but if I might continue, Mr. Chair.
To that topic, Representative Wilson.
Yes, please. Thank you, Representative Chairman and Representative Hawker. Would you please, when you're making your comments, say which fiscal note that you're talking about, because there's three of them.
Yes, ma'am. And that was a general comment about the fiscal notes, period, and that would have been about the process within the Department of Environmental Conservation, appropriation water, allocation water quality, about what it would take to run and operate this program. That's the lead fiscal note. They do expect ongoing, long-term commitments out of DNR and potentially Department of Law to continue to operate the program. So that would have been a comprehensive question about what is it truly getting us into from a long-range, outrange cost. Some sense of how they would envision a program coming together. But on a specific note, I would go, you know, I'll look first to fiscal note number one, which is the basic note from Environmental Conservation Water, Water Quality. And in details on this one, one thing catches my attention, the services line, I guess, I'm going to go down the line from the top.
Sure.
Personal services expenses are level out in FY19. There's also an additional, and it's expected to be funded through an RSA, additional new services required at natural resources. And between the two, they're about $1.3 million a year. And frankly, they're listed level out through FY19. That's 6 years forward. It just seems, if we can guarantee no increase in state wages and benefits for 6 years, I would love to see that coming out of the department. And if it's not expected to be an accurate statement, I just wonder, you know, should that not be considered in a, you know, potential escalator clause somewhere in there? But it just concerns that I have about what I call truth in budgeting. The other technical nit, the services line, FY14 and FY15, there's detail listings in behind on fiscal note number one. There's the front of the fiscal note has an $879,000 and a $908,000 services line. The details that are behind in the descriptor only account for $849,000 and $854,000, and I'm just wondering what the difference might be. And quite frankly, an answer I don't know is a good answer, but it's something I'd like to see resolved.
That is indeed drilling down. If someone has an answer to that missing, was it $30,000? Or how much the difference between those figures, that'd be great.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I don't know at the moment, but we can certainly find that for you.
Thank you. And if I might continue. As we look and compare the fiscal note for Environmental Conservation Water, Water Quality number one with fiscal note number two for Natural Resources Administrative Support, Office of Project Management and Permitting, we can see if we compare it to the services anticipated, the detail on page two of the DEC fiscal note. A $361,800 RSA to DNR, and we can see that that's matched, of course, at DNR. DNR is then showing how they're going to spend that money, totally copacetic. And then on page three of that note, in FY14, we see 566.7 going forward, RSA, and that's matched by the DNR fiscal note. All well and good. But when we look then to the Department of Law fiscal note, so DEC is off the hook, but it's the Department of Law that my question goes to, is we show the DEC fiscal note describes 187,500 RSA to Department of Law continuing for the entire 6 years of this program, or this startup work.
Sure.
And if we look at the Department of Law fiscal note, unlike the DNR fiscal note, which shows the IA receipt authority to spend money for an additional service, Department of Law has a zero. Now, what that would imply to me is that the Department of Law is going to be able to accommodate all the work expected by DNR, and through an RSA, will be transferring spending authority, funding authority, to the department. DEC will be basically transferring a bunch of general fund spending authority over to Department of Law, the amount of $157,000 a year. The DEC note shows they are not receiving that spending authority, and it would seem to me that a technically correct fiscal note, that's telling me that Department of Law is, they are saying they're not going to need to spend any additional money to accommodate what they're going to be getting paid for. And it would seem to me that a proper fiscal note, and if they're going to be able to do it with existing resources, which is a wonderful thing, that there should be an offset, an increase in IA receipts, offset by a reduction in our obligation and need to provide general funds to the Department of Law in that amount. Because if you're going to be able to collect the general funds through a billing over to DEC, not need to incur any additional costs. I mean, we're not here to, at least I'm not here to pad their budget. So I'm just wondering why there's not a increase in IA receipt authority matching the receipt authority that's going to be granted by the DEC fiscal note, offset by a reduction in another spending authority, unless they're, you know, again, taking on, and if they're going to just be taking on additional money without having to incur additional costs, it's just relevant to our, in my opinion, truth in budgeting for all agencies.
Well, you've raised a number of questions. I'm glad to see Ms. Hess back up here. Can you take those on one at a time?
I'll do my best, but I must admit that I'm not the fiscal expert for the Department of Law. And I hope I do understand, through the chair, Representative Hawker's questions, and so apologize if I get a little wayward and we have to go back to our fiscal folks to get more answers.
And Mr. Chair, I really wouldn't try. I was not trying to put you on the spot.
Not a worry.
In paper form. It is a fiscal question, but I have a hard time moving something out of this committee that I feel has a deficient fiscal note attached to it.
Okay. Ms. Hess, if you can address that. And actually, I would looking at the second page of the Department of Law fiscal note, and I'm no expert in reading fiscal notes, but it says that DOL has sufficient interagency receipt authority for that 187.5. But
yes.
So,
but the fiscal notes as written then give Department of Law an extra $187,500 to spend as they wish. That's an increase in their budget.
And I think I do appreciate that part of the comment here. We wouldn't be looking to pad the agency's budget through this process. This is somewhat following what we did with the 402 program, where the services that law rendered in helping DEC take on the 402 program, that was the intent here. It's not to add discretionary budget funds to the Department of Law beyond what it might need to commit in terms of work for this particular program. What we did here was we went back and we looked at the amount of effort that had been put into for the 402 program and came up for evaluating 402 and preparing a package to apply for that program. And based on what we thought might be needed for inflationary purposes, and so certainly the offset is intended. If there is an amendment needed to the fiscal note, I'm sure we can work on that and provide that. But that is the intent.
I'd ask you to think about, because again, you can say, matter, one side we're showing money being transferred to the agency, the other side the agency is not acknowledging its receipt. So did the money just disappear?
No, it didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I understand the question. I guess with that...
And if it does, by the way, my legislature budget could use it, so I have no problem with that.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I would like to go back to fiscal and also speak with DEC and DNR on this because they helped us prepare, obviously, the fiscal note for this.
Thank you very much. I
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Along those lines, Ms. Hesse, if I could ask you, the $187.5 per year, that is intended to provide legal services as DEC goes through the primacy application preparation. That's not necessarily for defense of this, should it be, go to Ninth Circuit, is that correct?
It does not, I believe, include that. I'd have to check. I don't believe it does. It really goes to the putting the nuts and bolts together for a program.
Okay.
It may include, I'm not sure, I'd have to get back to you.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, Chairman Sadler, this is Larry Hartig again. On that, the appeal would actually be an appeal of EPA's decision, so they would be the party responding. And so the state at most would maybe look at intervening in the case, but it would be EPA that would have the laboring oar.
Okay. Along those lines, a slightly related question. Is there any financial assistance provided by the EPA for states like ours who are contemplating taking over primacy? Sometimes there's, you know, federal impact or seed money to help you go through the process. Is that the case in this primacy?
Chair Sadler, I will let Commissioner Hartig speak to this in greater depth, but there is some grant funds that are made available to any state for wetlands regulatory purposes. They're very limited in funding, and there is a culling process that EPA would go through region by region to try and award grant funds for including purposes of looking at primacy, 404 primacy. And beyond that, I'll let Commissioner Hartig or Michelle Bonnet Hale answer the question.
Yes, this is Commissioner Hartig. I'll let Michelle take that one on because I know that she's active and been talking with them.
Name again.
Michelle Bonnet Hale. Chairman Sadler, EPA does have a grant program, and it's actually called the Wetlands Program Development Grant Program. And the program includes work that might be done to submit an application, but it also is much more broad than that. So it applies to a lot of states that are not planning to apply for 404 primacy. It includes things like developing a wetlands program plan, but also work that includes sort of up to submitting an application for 404. And as Ruth said, it's competitive among different states, and we are in the process of applying for that grant right now.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions on financial matters related to this bill? No? Any other questions in general from the committee on the bill? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this could be for the commissioner or anybody at the table. Just looking forward in terms of priorities for the department, do you see other priorities being pushed aside because we may not be able to fund further program development, you know, outside of what it would take for the fiscal note for these bills? Or how does this fit into overall priorities? I know a couple of us were on the budget subcommittee for the department, and there were other priorities discussed.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Hartig. That's a good question because as you look at adding anything to your department, you wonder how that would affect things if in a declining revenue scenario. And the way I look at it is in the state of Alaska, the way that we're going to solve our fiscal problem is with resource development. You know, we don't have manufacturing, we don't have large population growth, economic growth of that kind is due to increased productivity in the state. It's going to come from natural resource development. And when I look at just 30 years of permitting resource projects, I look at what are the critical permits, this is certainly one of them. And when I look at the impact of how the 404 process goes on a particular project and how that can influence other companies to decide whether to go forward with their project when they see how their neighbor got treated, I know that that's very important too. So if I step back and look at it less colloquially than just from a department perspective, I think 404 becomes more magnified than if I look at 404 in terms of how it might affect things, other programs within DEC AI. I get more worried because it would probably be a program that would be in part supported by general fund, although it would also be supported probably to a fair degree by permitting fees. So I think that from a state perspective, I think that 404 permitting primacy should have a pretty high priority, at least to take a really solid look at it and see what is the best path forward in the future of the state, resource development in the state. And from a DEC perspective, I guess I'm willing to take my chances, is the way I would put it, that we'll keep advocating for the priorities. We'll try to look for efficiencies within the department and put those priorities in front of the legislature and ask you guys to make the hard decision.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, I don't feel like I have enough information to understand there's a problem. And, you know, we're looking at spending millions of dollars to even look at to see if there is a problem. And I don't know if there's complaints coming forward. I know we talked about CD5, and that might be a one-case situation. I don't know. And maybe that's corrected through the process that we just went through with the permitting process. Maybe we won't see a situation like that again due to the fact that we saw problems along the way. And I understand that if we have problems such as CD5, that, you know, we definitely want to be able to have more control. But we just got rid of coastal zone management just recently, you know, and I have concerns about growing government for the purposes of looking at, you know, whether we should grow government or not grow government. I mean, I'm just really, I wish I knew what the problem was. And without knowing the backlogs that we're seeing, but not having an idea of how long it takes to go through the process currently, and then to be able to forecast how much we can shrink that process, you know, it's just really hard to know that we need to be looking into this any further. So I don't know if there's any more information you guys can, I mean, it sounds all anecdotal, but if you can give me some more concrete stuff that we can look at and see how we can be more effective, that would be really helpful.
Before you answer that, Mr. Crawford, Representative Wilson has something to add to that.
I just want to say, in Southeast, we have permitting problems all the time. I mean, you would not believe how many calls I get. A lot. So, you know, I think this is something that we really need to think about, because we get them all the time.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Mr. Crawford, do you have a response to either of those comments?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, of Tom Crawford with DNR. I mean, I share your concerns, because there's a lot that we don't know at this point in time. But I think one of the points and what I'm involved with is the coordination of the permitting process for a lot of different projects. And OPUMP has project coordinators that are involved with oil and gas and mining and alternative energy and just a wide spectrum of projects. And one of the as we stated, that the 404 permit is now the lead federal permit, and the Army Corps of Engineers, therefore, is the de facto NEPA lead federal agency. And one of the things that has become very frustrating for us is that during the NEPA process, we have a seat at the table as a cooperating agency. Now, a cooperating agency isn't truly a full seat at the table, but it's a good seat at the table. But then what happens is that once the NEPA process is concluded, the door is shut. And the federal agency then goes and makes permitting decisions behind a closed door. We don't have a seat at that table. And frankly, that's the table that we would like to be present at, that we think that we can help to assure that the best interests of Alaska and Alaska-specific technical information is included in those permitting decisions. And absent a greater role in that process, we feel that we're at a disadvantage and unable to fully participate in that process.
Question from Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and more of a, I guess, an observation. And Mr. Crawford, if you could either agree or disagree, but you know, take CD5 as an example, and I'm sure there will be future issues that come up that involve some kind of a delay to Alaska's ability to expand its resource development, and specifically to expand its oil industry. But you know, CD5 really, it's the gateway to the NPRA. Further development in that area will result in revenues to the state of Alaska, and to have those revenues delayed because we don't have control over the permitting process or the 404 permitting process. We're talking about fiscal notes that are a couple million bucks, but that significant delays on significant projects translates into maybe a couple billion dollars. Is that a fair observation?
Co-chair Feige through the chair, I think those are all valid concerns, and certainly that's part of this evaluation process of just what might it be worth to the state, and these are big ticket issues, and I think it behooves the state to take a serious look at what those advantages might be and what it might cost, and just to make an informed decision.
To that point, before Mr. Sensi's question, did the state go through a similar process of evaluating? How long was the evaluation portion of the seeking primacy for NPDES process? That's not grammatical, but how long was the evaluation, and when did the decision get made to actually proceed with primacy for water quality?
Co-Chair Sadler, Michelle Bonnet-Hale, DEC Director of Water. The evaluation process for primacy, actually, it was evaluated over the years several times, but then the process before we had our application approved was probably about a five-year process. So that was evaluation, working back and forth with the EPA, actually determining if we were going to go forward, and probably preceded by a couple of years even before that with working with the work group to determine if we did want to go forward. So it was a longer process than the process that we've got outlined in SB 27, and in part that's because we didn't have the experience that we do now, and that's some of the confidence that I was speaking about in terms of having that experience under our belt. We have a much better feel for what we're doing now as we begin this evaluation.
So research and reconnaissance is part of the process, but having done a lot of that, you're kind of hipped up on the process.
Co-Chair Sadler, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Seaton, your question.
Thank you, and I guess, I can understand, and I do fully understand the impact of delays, but, I mean, most of the delays we're talking about, CD5 and other, could be Kibata, could be Bridge of Nenana, any of those things are explicitly in the federal realm anyway, because those are navigable waters. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, doing this process, $14 million is a fiscal note in 5 years, thereabouts, 12 new state employees to investigate this, when what I'm hearing is a statewide general permit process, which you can go through now without $14 million, and this gets us, at least Virginia decided that got almost all the benefits without all the expenses and new employees and all that. So why would we not, as a legislature, have you try to go forward on a sped-up basis doing the statewide general permit instead of spending 4 years in the process mainly looking at 404 primacy and just getting some of the concurrent information for statewide general permits? I mean, why would we go down this route of 404 when we can go directly to statewide general permits, which appear to get us almost all of the benefits and even coordination on the navigable water areas, which we wouldn't get with the 404 permit primacy.
What's that one?
No, this is Commissioner Hartig. I'll take the first crack at it, if I may.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Through the chair, first off, I think there's a misconception here, and that is that the programmatic general permit that we're talking about, or a series of those would be for projects that have a common impact, you know, that are similar to other projects, such as we're talking about placer mines and in the interior, or a shale gas, shallow gas, unconventional gas type project where you have multiple wells that might be at wetland sites, but that all look alike and have basically the same impact, and also the impacts have to be individually and cumulatively minimal. That's quite a distinction from the other types of projects that you mentioned, like CD5 and Tanana River Bridge, projects that are relatively unique and have a relatively large impact relative to the other types that I'm talking about that would be under a general permit. And so a general permit, more general permits, is not a panacea. What you want to do is just to maximize your effort there as you also look at pursuing the primacy of the individual, the authority to issue the individual 404 permits for the larger and more unique projects.
Good. Representative Wilson, question?
I don't have a question, but I just want to make a comment because it's so frustrating. I think it's really important that we can be able to do some of these general permits because in my area, we have someone that wants to put a culvert in their driveway that it's been held up for years. It's just ridiculous, some of the things that get held up. And, we have it for bigger construction projects, and we have it for little tiny projects, and we just have it all over the place. And we have got to do something so that we can put some of these things in general areas or groups so that we can do something, because it's so frustrating for the public and people that want to build a house. It costs more, a lot more, just because of the fact that they've it's been detained several years. The cost of their house has gone up, and they can't afford the house anymore. I mean, it's just, it's so frustrating. And I can't imagine what it's frustrating for my constituents, because it's frustrating for me just hearing about it. So, something's got to be done.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Question, and Representative Seaton.
And just on that point, you know, I fully agree, and until this last couple of years when we were doing with the general permit from 404 permit from the Corps for 80-some miles of gas lines throughout the entire lower peninsula, I was even unaware that, you know, this could be done, especially as easily as it can be. So I think that I agree entirely with Representative Wilson that we need to concentrate our efforts on these regional or statewide general permits so that the projects are not delayed. But when we get to one of these big projects that's almost invariably on navigable waters, going to primacy on 404 general permitting, I'm still not understanding how that is going to solve any problem for us when the Army Corps is still going to be in primacy on almost every one of those large projects because they're on navigable waters or ephemeral streams into navigable waters and those things. So I guess I'm needing some more explanation on that.
Mr. Hartig, do you have can you address Representative Seaton's concerns regarding that issue?
Well, again, as Commissioner Hartig, through the chair, that is what we're intending to have the discussion with the Corps on, is to parse out how many of the permits that they have out there now that would be where we'd expect other permit applications like that in the future, and projects that we know may be coming down the pike. How many of those do they think and we agree with would be in those areas that would be excluded from primacy, and how many those would be within the areas where primacy would apply? And I think that the leap towards saying we know the answer to that right now, to me, is scary, because I don't think we know the answer to that right now. I think that would take some effort by the Corps and us to look at that and come back to you with, you know, this, these are our estimates. But that's what we would do. That's what you would get through that, that first year or two. And like I said, when we come back to you, we're anticipating it would be more like by fiscal year 2016, not 5 years from now. So when I hear we're concerned about $14 million in 5 years, well, I think we'll be closer to a decision point well before then.
Okay. Mr. Hardy, let me ask you this question. What are the future decision points? Should this go through and become law, what when would the legislature again have a chance to weigh in or to encourage or slow down the process of seeking primacy for wetlands?
Yes, Chairman. I think that the short answer is you control it each year because you control the budget. And I guess you could always come back and ask us and change our budget, even if you had put it in there in our base budget. But the what I would look at is when we would probably in about 2 years from now, two fiscal years from now, at the end of fiscal year 15, we should have a pretty good idea of what would be need to go into an application, what jurisdiction that we would get, what types of permits would be within that arena. We'd also would have had a lot of discussion with the Corps on state programmatic general permits. So I think at that point that around that point, not at that point, we would be back to you and saying these are the resources we need for the next step, you know, which is start really building up the program. And so I'm thinking that within that 2, maybe 3 year period or so that we'd be back to you for the additional resources if, and that's a big if it looked like this was a benefit to the state to go forward.
Okay. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just going back to the timing issue a little bit, because the bill that would be considered, you know, similar to the one we're passing today was signed into law in 2005, so it sounds like the work group started in 2003. The application wasn't done until 2008. And then we didn't fully implement it until the end of 2012 through the four phases. So really it looks like it took about a decade for the previous program. And the department hasn't convened a similar work group to work with the permit applicants prior to this legislation. So wouldn't you expect that to take some amount of time since that work hasn't already been done to, you know, that might make it last more like the 3 to 5 years that we saw before?
Through the chair, I'll try to answer that, maybe ask Michelle Hale to add to it. We were starting with an unknown when we started the 402 application process. Didn't have the experience at going through the whole application process, and the same was true for EPA Region 10. It was a pretty new experience for them, too. And so there was a number of questions that came up on the way, along the way, and so the application went in, but when I came in as commissioner in 2007, I remember there was over 200 and some deficiencies that EPA had found in our application. And working with them, we quickly got that down to a handful, and then went back to the legislature where we had to get some actual changes in state statute to get state authority lined up with federal authority correctly to get primacy. So all that took a while, and that was the time period leading up to 2008. And then we decided collectively between EPA and the state that since this was a pretty new experience for both of us, that we would go in phases. We would phase in the primacy and take that in steps. Here we think that we'll have a better picture of what's involved and be able to move quicker, so we're shortening up the time frame. I don't expect that it would take anything like 10 years. In terms of a work group, that's still a bit left to be decided, but we're contemplating that certainly, where as we would put the application together as a kind of a parallel process, what we would do is where we get to certain decision-making steps and would want input from the public, that we could get that maybe through a work group, but I don't see that being something that would add time to the project.
Okay. With that, Commissioner, and the committee's indulgence, we do have at least one person signed up to give us public testimony. So before the committee meeting runs out, I'm going to open public testimony and ask if there's anybody in the room. I believe we have Mr. Sullivan in the room to testify. And if anybody in the room wants to testify, please sign up at the sheet at the side of the hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is James Sullivan, and I work with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Just a few things I wanted to talk about. I've been listening to a lot of the proceedings in this committee and other committees about this legislation. And I want to start off with that it seems to me that they keep discussing members of DEC, either the commissioner or other people, or DNR, all the unknowns. I think one of the difficulties here is that there's a great deal that is known. Mr. Chairman, you have a wonderful map behind you. It's a great map. I love looking at it. We could easily get information from the Army Corps of Engineers today and outline, not that I'd wanted to face that map, but we could line up every single navigable water. It's on their website. We could find out to the mile what falls under the section, I believe it's called Section 10, Rivers and Harbors Act, and what would not. In every single time someone's testified on this, they've made these references to these huge delays in CD5. And there have been huge delays, and I think there's still delays going on at this moment. But to be clear, the Colville River, which is where all these delays or substantial delays took place because they wanted to build a bridge over the Colville. And they couldn't because the Army Corps said no. And that's where the big delays came from about 2 years ago. And the Colville River is very clearly falls under the Rivers and Harbors Act. So even if we had primacy 2 or 3 years ago, we would have not been able to start the work in CD5. I think this is important information to have out, and I don't know why they keep referencing this, because before you guys spend, it looks like it's going to be a minimum of $7 million a year to run this program. You should have a very clear understanding of what you get and what you don't get. You don't buy a truck and drive it off the lot until you look under the hood and see if you got the engine that you paid for. And I'm concerned that our legislature is going in the wrong direction, moving very quickly on this, particularly since there's a conference call this Friday. Maybe we get some of that information from that conference call and the participants that are on that conference call to figure out what's going on. One other point I wanted to make was that a lot of discussions have been on the 402 and the 404 and what we've learned. But it's important to note that 402 allows for a phasing in process. So that even though the process did take, I believe, about 10 years, and that we did just get primacy in this past year, I don't know the exact timeline, but I'm sure the commissioner can tell you that the DEC was issuing permits, at least at some scale, very early on, or years ago. It was phased in over time, and we just received the full primacy. You cannot do that with 404. It's an all or nothing. Yet we seem to be putting staff in place at this current time, yet we might not be issuing a permit 4, 5, possibly 10 years down the road. And one other thing that that hasn't been talked about, at least today, and I've heard in other committees, is the process that we could put all this in place, spend approximately millions of dollars every year on issuing these permits, and we're never going to be the boss of this program. We're always going to have to get approval through EPA. EPA will always have a veto authority on any permit that we issue through 404. I think that's very disconcerting. It's one thing to be very frustrated. I know, as some of the representatives have talked about in just the past few minutes, about how these delays take place. I can't think of anything more frustrating as spending $7 million putting dozens of people in place and then having some other group tell you no, you can't do what you want to do. I think that has to be discussed at great length before we start hiring people and start thinking we're going to take over this program. One other thing to note is that the delays have been very anecdotal. There hasn't been hard evidence about what these delays are. We have the Army Corps. They have an office right here in Juneau. We can walk down to them and ask them. if they have the information about what are these actual delays between the general permits, which seem to be done very efficiently, at least from I saw the same presentation that was given a couple of weeks ago, and over, I think it was either 84 or 85% of all general permits are finished within 60 days. I think it'd be a difficult time for us to spend $7 million and see what, that we went from 84 to 89 or 90%. I don't think that that's the best use of our funds to put it in that direction. I think there are a lot of things. I think we're putting the cart before the horse, to put it simply, Mr. Chairman. And I hope that you can get a lot more answers to this. And I'd love to see if we could get at least a map, because it's very clearly put out on their website what we're getting and what we're not getting.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. I appreciate that. Is there anybody else here that wants to testify in the room? Is everybody online?
Yeah.
Okay, seeing and hearing none, I'm going to close public testimony at this point. And other questions for any of the commissioners or deputy commissioners and attorneys we have here? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, because the two phases to this process, of course, what we'd be authorizing is, you know, the ability to do the application. But just what level of confidence the commissioner or the director has that our application would be successful, because there's little history of states doing this. Only two other states have done this. So, you know, still relatively new that that a state would try and take this over, because I guess the worst outcome could be having spent all these millions of dollars on the applications only to have our application not approved, because then it would have been a huge waste of money. So I guess, is there a reason you're feeling confident that we would be successful in our application based on other success of the department, or what gives you feeling of confidence about the application?
And who are you addressing your question to?
The commissioner or the director, I suppose, whoever.
Commissioner Harding, would you like to answer?
Yeah, sir, I'll be happy to try to answer that question to the chair. First off, I would strongly object to the concept that this would be a wasted effort even if we didn't get primacy. We go into it with the full expectation that if it looked to the best interest of the state to obtain primacy, we'd file an application, we'd be successful. That would be what we would be shooting for, and we wouldn't be going after if I didn't think we would get it. And I think that's the whole state team's opinion on it. But I think, too, that the reality is that by putting a spotlight on the whole 404 permitting program, both the general and individual permits, and saying, is this the best that can be done? You know, can the state do better? You know, that asking those questions will be beneficial to everyone. And no one's asking those questions right now. And so I think that in itself, bringing that attention and finding out where the weaknesses are, whether it's the feds or the states that are running the program or whatever aspects of the program, is a good thing, particularly in the time of declining revenue. So I see it as a worthy effort, particularly, again, where 404 permitting is so critical. But, yeah, I think that the likelihood that we would get primacy, it depends both on the quality of our application, but also on the willingness of the federal agencies to work with us. And, again, our experience has been that with the 402 and now with the 404, at least the start of this, is that we would expect good and open collaboration, you know, from the federal agencies on this. It'll be give and take, back and forth, as we both evaluate what the opportunities are and the best way to proceed. But I have no reason at this point to believe that we wouldn't be able to put together an application that would be successful.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't help but laugh at the representative comment about spending all this time and effort and then having our permit denied. It makes me think back to all the people that have spent all the time and effort to build houses in Southeast or build culverts in Southeast or CD5, even though it may not fall under this program, only to have their permit denied. And if we can take some control of that and we can help that, as a business person wanting to invest in the state, that would give me some comfort, as opposed to, so imagine our apprehension of going out and, gosh, we can't do this because we may get our permit tonight. people do business in Alaska every day, or try to do business in Alaska every day, thinking, oh my God, what if we got our permit tonight? We owe it to our citizens and ourselves to take as much control as we can over our future. And I think this is just one way to do it. So I appreciate the indulgence. There was no question in there, Mr. Chairman.
That's right. We indulge that. Representative Feige, Co-Chair Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner, in the letter you wrote to the Senate Finance Committee, you mentioned the number of, I guess, 49 full-time positions and an annual budget for the Corps in state of $8 million. Are you aware of any plans for the Feds to scale back, or is that a is that one of those things that's always a potential, a possibility that they could start losing positions and thus also lose their ability to process permits to keep up with Alaska's needs?
Thank you, Representative Feige, through the chair. Director Tom Crawford mentioned earlier, there is two concerns that we have right now. One is the declining budgets that we have seen and that we are anticipating will continue to decline on with the Corps of Engineers. And second, just the loss of some key people that we've seen recently, permitting people that I know Tom and I have worked with perhaps for decades. And so we're seeing a loss of capacity on several fronts from the Corps. And at the same time, we're seeing a growing need for 404 permitting in the state. And so it's not a good situation. And whether the state's in a position to better deal with that, or the Corps of Engineers, or there's a better way of dealing with it collectively, that's what we need to explore.
Thank you. Final question, Representative Skitten.
Well, this is for the chair. There's been several references to admin reg review. Had a Army Corps of Engineers permit presentation, mm-hmm. and I would like to request that the chairs get the Army Corps of to give us that presentation, because we're talking a whole lot about permits that are happening or aren't happening, and apparently there's pie charts and there's information, and if we could have them testify directly to us, I think that would be helpful in our consideration.
Okay, we could make that request and make that available to the members. I would also note for the record that Representative Feige, Sitton, has made the Department of Environmental Quality report from Virginia on the pros and cons of assuming primacy made available as well. So we'll get that to you. And last question, comment?
Last comment, just so folks are thinking about it before they get that. In terms of denials, under the current program, less than 1% of the applications have been denied.
Is that a question or?
Just a comment, that very few denials are taking place.
Yep. There have been a couple of questions raised, and I think there's information out there that has some good answers to them. So we'll request information from Reg Review, make sure that, I mean, if you have other questions you'd like to have the commissioners or the deputy commissioners address, funnel them through us, we'll get them out, and we'll bring this up again very soon, and hope we can take action and answer the questions. So we're going to hold the bill over and adjourn at 2:57.